Hi, everybody. We are live. Coming at you on a bright, dark Monday night.
From the future.
Yeah, it's a bright day. Well, it was a bright day. Now it's 8 p.m. and it's going to be a much darker day. All right. Anyway, hi. We're live. This is my fault. This is, you know, some logistical challenges on my side this week. So, sorry. It's Monday, everyone. It's my fault. But
I'm going to start the show aggressively. I'm going to not get to our pre-approved pre-show, and I'm going to throw my dear friend John Syracuse under the bus and say that I, especially in Marker to a lesser degree, have been petitioning for every great once in a while daytime recording, which would be incredibly convenient if you live east of where we are, which is to say Europe or maybe even Asia. But John has indicated that his house is made of paper and there is literally no time during the day in the summertime that there are not weed eaters, lawn machines. What am I thinking
leaf
of?
Blowers.
Lawnmowers. Yeah,
leaf blowers is yes, what you exactly. care about. Leaf blowers and lawnmowers. My house is not made of paper. It is very sturdy, but the lawn, the leaf blowers are very loud.
So just let the record show that I am your favorite host, Europeans, because I've
been petitioning. Once we get to winter, once we get out of landscaping season, we can't actually do it, though.
Sure. I feel like there was a reason. You had some excuse for wintertime, too. I'm almost sure of it.
Yeah, it depends on if I'm, ferrying kids around at the time we want to record. And you would say, well, the kids probably have a regular schedule. We'll just work around it. No, of course they don't. It's just random. You must be on call at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at any time of the day.
Well, how long until Kate starts driving? It's about time, right?
Yeah. I just actually made an appointment for her to do the learner's permit application thingamabob. It's so bad in Massachusetts. Like, don't you know that people who are getting a learner's permit, chances are good that some of them might be minors? And they're like, make sure you bring your proof of residency. Just bring your utility bill or rent statement. It's like, no, she's 16. She doesn't have that. What else can I bring? So annoying. So hopefully I will successfully bring enough information to convince them that she lives in Massachusetts.
When we got the kids' passports, which we did kind of proactively because we're not currently planning on leaving the country imminently by any means. But when we did that, you know, with passports, you need, you know, all sorts of ridiculous documentation. And I had a manila folder per child with all of their, like, you know, birth certificate. I think both of them actually had expired passports, if memory serves, and all the other paraphernalia we thought they would need. And then I'm pretty sure I had a lockbox in the car of, like, basically any document that we considered valuable so I could just run to the car in case we needed something. Because inevitably, no matter how many times I go through the instructions, I will find a way to screw it up. So,
yeah, identification is fine. I've got all that social security card, expired passport, those things. It's a proof of residency in Massachusetts. There's a Massachusetts specific thing. They have all these things that you can choose from in the automated online form, and you can only choose from the things that are in the pop-up menu. And choices are not great because you need two of them, and I could pull off about one of them. Like, even the bank account thing isn't. It needs to have a canceled check. Well, she doesn't have a checking account. She's got a savings account, but no checking account. I'm not going to open a checking account for her so I can get a blank check that I can bring to... Anyway, I'll let you know how it goes.
Yes, please do. All right. We should start by pointing out we have done another members special because I'm an idiot and I like getting my feelings hurt. I decided I would roll the dice and see what John and Marco thought about John's of Bleecker Street, which is my beloved preferred pizza institution in Manhattan. And so what we did was we spent a truly absurd amount of money to get Goldbelly to send us two not particularly large pizzas per family and do that overnight from Manhattan to our respective households. And then we cooked them up much like we did with the I almost said frozen meals, but don't call them frozen meals, call them TV dinners. And so they all arrived at our desks at about the same moment. We talked about it on air. I will not tell you if my feelings were hurt or not, but I will tell you that it was an adventure to say the least. And so if you are not a member, you can go to atp.fm/join. You can join for as little as 1 month, although we'd love for you to stick around. If you join, you get access to all the member stuff that's ever happened. And we're up to, like, I don't know, 6-ish episodes, I think, something like that now.
Yeah,
and so you get access to all that. You could grab them all and then cancel your membership. We're not slimy. We let you do that. You'll hurt our hearts and our feelings, but you can do that. That is allowed. And so, I think once you check out all the perks, you will love it. So please check out atp.fm/join. Marco, John, anything to add?
If you could imagine what it would be like for Casey to try to convince two New Yorkers with strong opinions on pizza to try his pizza, you can see why this was a good episode. I suggest if you've been on the fence before about membership for whatever reason, you aren't a member yet, but you like when we, you know, argue about non-technical things. Or even
there was
discuss,
plenty of that.
Yeah, even just discuss non-technical things. These kind of member specials and this one in particular, it's a good venue for that.
Indeed. Come for the pizza talk, stay for the bagel talk. And also, I would like to point out just one more time, I probably made this point on the special, although I might have forgotten. My birth certificate says state of New York, my friend. Only two-thirds of your hosts, their birth certificate stays state of New York, and Marco is not one of them. I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah, but which one of us lives here? Oh,
yeah, that's fair.
Oh, that's right.
That's fair. Yeah, so we're all
when,
imposters.
When's the
one
last
way
time you lived there? You lived in New York, Casey?
I lived in New York, late 80s,
right,
I think.
John?
Yeah, something like that.
I go there every year, at least, unlike Casey. Did your parents live in New York when you were born, or they just drive there to give birth to you?
Is that a thing that people do?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to be offended. And to be honest, I started it by throwing you under the bus earlier, but I'm not sure how offended I should be. No, they were living, I believe they were living in Fort Montgomery at the time, which is nearish Newburgh. And I was born in Newburgh, which is probably, I'm now probably giving away some sort of top secret state thing.
Tell people the answers to your security.
Yeah,
question.
So there you go. Whoopsies. But anyways, but no, that's they right. lived in New York.
There's nothing in Newburgh for any security question to ask about.
That's also true.
I didn't know airport. Where any of those places were, so I assume they're all upstate, so never mind.
Yeah,
well, they're not upstate by most standards, but by your
Newburgh,
both of your standards.
Hold on. Newburgh is definitely upstate.
Oh, come on. It's not that far.
Marco lived in Brooklyn long
it's
enough
like
to,
two
to
hour
adopt,
drive north.
to adopt the Long
no,
Island definition
is.
Of
is
upstate.
Is it really? Then yes. Maybe my, I mean, no way. A two-hour drive from
Everything
Fire
is a
Island?
Everything is a two-hour drive when you go upstate.
Yeah, well, we established that. Frickin' Manhattan is 2 hours from Fire
That's
Island.
What I'm saying,
so,
yeah,
no, that doesn't. No, so like, how about this? John's a Bleecker. Let's just take that as a landmark. Let's see how far we are from Newburgh. Give me a second.
Go ahead, yeah.
This is extremely
as the
good
helicopter
programming.
Flies, or if you actually have to take roads.
No. I'm doing this on Google Maps. It's under an hour and a half, 70 miles.
Mm-hmm. Wait, hold on. In what? At what time of day?
Exactly.
Right now.
At
it's under
p.m.
an hour.
Also, 8 o'clock at night. All right, yeah, okay, right. On a Monday.
Yeah, try it anytime while the sun's.
I don't know, man. So you consider like the lake that we used to go to, you consider that like deeply upstate, I assume?
I wouldn't use the word deeply, but it's unquestionably upstate.
Hmm. All right. I have no leg to stand on here, so I'm gonna quit my arguing. But I guess to me, I'm not trying to say I'm right. I am not trying to say I'm right. But to me, I feel like anything within a couple of hours of the city is barely upstate.
So where is the
dividing line? A Harlem?
Philadelphia is within a couple hours of the city. Like, I mean, this makes no sense.
Okay. No. Okay, that's fair. So where is the dividing line? Is it 125th Street, for Christ's sakes?
It depends on the definition, but, you know, and different people have different definitions. The one definition every New Yorker can agree upon is upstate begins north of them. You know, no one thinks they live upstate. However,
right.
if you kind of, you know, plot like, you know, the bell curve of like, all right, well, where does upstate really begin to most people's opinions? You know, it certainly begins at least above like, you know, Westchester or Rockland counties and possibly even lower than that, depending on who you ask.
So you would this is going to sound argumentative. I really don't mean it that way. So you would say Westchester County is, you personally, Marco, would say is or is not upstate.
I personally would say no, but it's like, but it's not the city. Like, I would never say it's the city.
Sure.
It's definitely
okay.
Not. And it's not quite upstate, but it's like, it's certainly like a boundary. You know, upstate, it's kind of like the way the atmosphere of the Earth transitions to space.
But
like,
no,
it's not like a clear line.
I think that's reasonable, actually. That's where I'm fuzzy
when I was a kid growing up on Long Island, if we visited Marco's house is in Westchester, I would say that Marco lives upstate.
Literally everything is upstate. Like I'm just telling you what the
recognize that that's a very limited perspective, like that classic New Yorker cover that shows the map of the United States with the New Yorker's view of it, and it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And today I would probably say anything that's above Westchester, but I still feel in my bones the idea of like going to visit Marco would mean driving upstate.
And certainly like by the time you get like. Once you're more than, you know, 20 or 30 miles from the city, I think the argument is, yeah, you're pretty much upstate.
So 20 or 30 miles, you said miles or minutes? What did
it's
you
just a
just
ballpark,
say?
But I'm going to say, yeah, like something, you know, something on the order of like 20 or 30 miles. I'd say you're upstate.
Okay. I've learned something today. I mean, I certainly am in no position to be an authority on this particular argument. This does not match what I thought was the case, but I can't stress enough. I am the least reasonable person of the three of us to make this distinction. So that's fair. All right. So we'll put a link to the New Yorker's picture, which is, wasn't that in your Westchester house, actually, if
yeah,
I'm not mistaken?
I have it on the
in
wall.
In the kitchen or something?
It's funny. I had that on the wall of my bedroom growing up. Like my parents had that in the house, and I like kind of inherited it at some point and put it in my room. And when we were buying the house in Westchester, the previous owners had one like hanging on the wall. So I asked them, like, hey, if you leave that, I'll take it. And they didn't want it. So I'm like, great. So they left it on the wall. I just left it there.
This is a very good image. All right. Well, so now that we got that argument out of the way, I feel like we've accomplished something. So yeah, if you want to hear more of that, if you want to hear more of that, atp.fm/join.
So clearly we don't have strong opinions on New York things.
No, certainly not. All right, let's do some follow-up. Apparently, this is the follow-up that will not die. I mean, the follow-up that keeps continuing. Tell me about the latest developments with your Kobo and your e-readers.
I think this is it. I know I say this
You
every...
said that the last 2 weeks!
I know, I did! I think this is it. All right, so I mentioned last episode I had switched from the Kobo Sage to the slightly smaller Kobo Libra 2 device, and a couple of people pointed out that Libra 2 doesn't support Dropbox. Which I didn't know at the time. It's like I'd only used it for like a day, and so I hadn't noticed. Oh, this feature that I like, this Dropbox feature that the Sage has, the Libra 2 doesn't actually have it, and I was a little disappointed by that. And
okay,
I thought,
so pause. Right. What remind me what was the draw for Dropbox integration? Because that is not something I feel like I have ever wanted on the Kindle, but I have a feeling you're using it for a purpose that I either am not expecting or just not something that I do. So remind me, what's the purpose there?
Well, the main purpose and the reason it's on the Sage supports a stylus where you can like draw or take notes on pages. Main reason I think it's there is so you can like export your notes that you
make
you know, into something that's easily accessed elsewhere. But what I use it for is I have ebooks from various sources that, you know, like sometimes if you buy like an not pirated, if you buy like an O'Reilly one or something like that, like sometimes you'll buy an EPUB file and like or like you'll buy something that is downloadable as an EPUB file without DRM. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a lot of like, you know, the like tech instructional stuff a lot of times comes this way. I bought a couple of ebooks recently like, that came that way. And so you'll have an EPUB file like, all right, how do I read this easily? And you can, you know, drag it into Apple Books or whatever, or I can drop it in this Dropbox folder that I just have a Dropbox folder now for the Kobo, and any EPUB files or PDFs I can stick there, and then I can get them on the Kobo and read them that way. So that's my main use.
Is there no, and I'm viewing everything through the lens of Kindle because it's the only thing I'm familiar with. With the Kindle, you get like a bespoke email address, I think at like Kindle.com or something like that, and you can email a PDF or an EPUB or what have you to there, and then it will send you an email back and be like, are you sure you want to do this?
No, it came from your email. No, well, you can give it like permitted email address sources.
See,
to say,
I
like,
swear I
if
did
I
that,
send
but...
it from this, and that's how Instapaper's Kindle integration works. It was a long time ago. I reverse engineered the Kindle Mobi format the way they were doing like newspaper and magazine periodical support, because they would devise this like table of contents structure out of it. And so I reverse engineered that, figured out what they were doing, and then did it with Instapaper. So Instapaper would basically generate, and it still works this way, it would generate a Kindle format periodical file and send it to that email address that you would enter in the Instapaper control panel.
Right.
Anyway, it's a little bit tricky with Kindles because at least back then, I don't know if this is still the case. I think it might be. But back then, Kindles didn't support EPUB. They had their own custom format that was based on the ancient Mobi or MobiPocket format. And you could email documents to their service, and it would actually convert them to Kindle format on Amazon's end and then send them over to Kindle. And Kobo, as far as I know, doesn't need to do that. It seems like the device just natively opens EPUBs without any other effort involved.
But my point in interrupting earlier was that there exists such a thing with Kobo as well. There's some email you can send things to?
No. So the way Kobo normal, as far as I can tell, I looked for that. As far as I can tell, to send stuff to it electronically, the only way to do it is this Dropbox integration on the Sage. And apparently the only other way to get stuff on it is to connect it to your computer with a USB cable, and it shows up as a USB storage device, and you can drag files over that way, which is fine, but not great, you know? Anyway, so I posted about this on Mastodon, and a few people, including Stefano Costantini, wrote in that, including Stefano Costantini, wrote in that there's actually a hack that, I mean, and I use the term hack very loosely, it's very easy. There's this third-party like hack app called Nickel Menu for Kobos, and the way you hack this is you connect it to your computer as a drive, and you just put this file like on the drive, and when you eject it, the Kobo sees this file, reboots, and like it must have some kind of like, you know, checking for, you know, plugins kind of system. That's how it feels. It feels like an OS plugin that's kind of like unofficial, but the Kobo just loads it. And then once you load this plugin, then you have an extra menu on the bottom of your Kobo, and there's a few little incantations you could put in this config file, one of which will enable Dropbox support on the Libre 2, and there's also, the Libre 2 version is super easy. There's apparently a couple other methods you can use for other, like, older Kobos. Anyway, all this is to say, in like 5 seconds, I had Dropbox support hacked onto my Libre 2 by basically sticking this file on the USB drive version of it, and that was it. Like, that's all I had to do. So I'll put the links in the show notes. Obviously, you know, when you're installing like random hacks from the internet onto a device, it is worth considering, like, what is the security surface area that I'm exposing here? Like, you know, and so, you know, so what I did for the Dropbox support was I have a secondary Dropbox account that only has access to like one folder, and then I share it with my primary account. So that way, because I figure like if this third party thing ends up, you know, being untrustworthy in the future or presently or whatever, you know, what do they have access to? Well, they have access to a handful of ebooks, and that's it. Like, you know, a Dropbox account that has access to none of my other stuff. So the surface area I decided was small. Obviously, you know, you can make your own decisions on that. It's still like a device on your network and stuff like that, so that's up to you. But I decided this hack was worth it, and now I have Dropbox, and it's great. There's a couple other things that it enables that I don't really need, so I'm just really using it for that.
That's cool. So we'll have some links that Marco provided in the show notes. John, we have all sorts of genuinely interesting news and feedback and whatnot with regard to multiple displays on M1 and M2 Macs. We were talking about, I don't remember when in the episode we were talking about it. We were talking about how the MacBook Air doesn't support more than one external display. And we were, you know, trying to theorize whether or not that was Apple being jerks and doing that in software, or is it really a hardware problem or something? So what is the verdict on this, John?
Yeah, it was in the context of the 15-inch MacBook Air. People were saying, saying 15-inch MacBook Air is great, except in corporate environments, people really want two displays. And if the M1 and M2 only support one.
Right.
So Mathis Woolworld says the M1 and M2 chips only have two display controllers, one for the built-in display and one that can run the external display. The display controllers are not part of the GPU. They are separate bits on the SoC. On the Mac Mini, the internal display controller signal is piped out to a chip that converts it to HDMI. So that's why the Mac Mini's got an HDMI port on the back. The controller that drives the internal display seems not to be able to output display port signals. It seems from die shots that Apple's using a lot of die area for the display controllers. Richard Stevens continues that Hector Martin, who does Asahi Linux, how do you pronounce that?
Asahi, and it's I think it's actually, it's Hector Marcan, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Love this, but Richard Stevens says Hector Martin, but I think you're right. Anyway, Asahi Linux. It's the Linux that runs on your M1 and M2 Macs, right? And they've been figuring out how to tap into all of the hardware features of the M1 and M2 SoCs, including, you know, the GPUs and the display drivers and everything, so they know a lot about these internals. Anyway, Hector had a bunch of tweets that were since deleted, but Richard found them in the Internet Archive. Here's what Hector had to say. Why does the M1/M2 only support one external display? Because Apple's display controllers are so fancy pants that the M1 Max has more silicon dedicated to display controllers than CPU cores. They can't fit any more of these on the cheap chips. Compare the display area and the die shot below to the power CPU cores, excluding the L2 cache. One display controller is larger than two power CPU cores combined, with enough spare left over to cover the efficiency CPUs as well. M1 Max has four of them, plus the internal one, which is on top of the CPUs, not annotated in the die shot. So I actually additionally annotated the die shot that's in our little show notes here. We'll try to put a link to the old Twitter thread and the show notes for you to look at. you can see that the display controllers are pretty large, especially when, again, when you compare them to the power CPU.
Is that performance? Rather than power, performance,
power, whatever. Like the good ones, the fast ones, the big ones, right? The efficiency CPU cores are really small. I'm not reading that from the text because in the text it's PCPU and ECPU as abbreviations. Yep. It's kind of cheating because like, oh, just exclude the cache. Well, you can't really exclude the cache because you're including the in what looks to be very regular memory region the display controllers. But anyway, all this is to say is this is a hardware limitations of the SoC. And Apple decided to make it this way. And one reasonable theory about why they decided to make it this way is that the display controllers are surprisingly large. When you're budgeting out how much space and therefore how much power and how much cost you have to allocate to all different functionality on an SoC, maybe for your low-end chip, you decide, two display controllers should be enough. And so you burn almost as much area as half of the power CPU cores. I did it again. Performance CPU cores, as you did in the other. Now, doesn't mean that Apple can't change their mind about that. It could be that having the M1 and M2 both be like this, only support two external displays with two display controllers, has garnered enough complaints that the M3 may make a different choice. We'll see. So stay tuned for that. But anyway, on the M1 and M2. The display support is not Apple artificially limiting you to something. It is a decision Apple made when they designed the M1 and M2 SoC in terms of allocating space for drivers. But that doesn't mean, as we've talked about in many past shows and we will now talk about again, that you can't actually have two displays attached to your M1 and M2. How can that be? So Edward Munn writes and says, it is possible to get the M1/M2 MacBook Air to support multiple external monitors by using a dock that supports display length with the correct drivers installed. DisplayLink does have its drawbacks, however. You can only watch DRM content in a browser by disabling hardware rendering. You cannot watch content within the TV app, and a message displays when logging in saying that the screen is being monitored.
Oh,
besides that.
Yeah. I don't know. A lot of people are in this setup, and I don't know if these are universal. I think you can use DisplayLink stuff and not see some of these, but anyway, I don't speak from much experience. So Edward continues, despite these drawbacks, it does allow for a one cable solution for multiple monitors and charging. And then Edward says, lastly, I find it amusing that this M2 MacBook Air can natively support a 4K HDR 144Hz monitor or even a 6K monitor, but requires workarounds to display two tiny 1080p monitors. I mean, it just goes to show, it's like, it's not the resolution or the number of pixels. It's the fact that, hey, are you a separate display that I have to deal with? Then I have to have a display controller for you or I have to do something else. Steve McWee writes, I have two 24-inch HP monitors running off a base model M1 Air using the Wavelength USB 3.0 to HDMI adapter. And finally, Lior Shakade says, yes, DisplayLink is an external driver. Yes, it uses screen recording to send data out as data packets over Thunderbolts instead of using native display control protocol. Yes, docks that support it are less common and more expensive than comparable alternatives. But at the end of the day, it does the job of connecting multiple external displays to M1/M2 Max. And the reason I think this is relevant is because in my experience in the corporate world, terrible docks like this that support multiple displays were ubiquitous. They were everywhere. Even before ARM on Mac, everyone had one of these third-party docking things that you would connect your laptop to that would let you have multiple displays, whether it's for your Macs or for your Dell laptops or whatever it was. I don't know. Did they all use this DisplayLink tunneling video over USB, or was it just a common product? But either way, I think this is the corporate solution to, hey, I've got an M1 or M2 and I want more than one monitor. It's like, well, deal with this. It's a little bit janky. It's a little bit weird. I bet the video quality probably has some compromises as well. I don't know all the technical details, but that's what you have to do. But, and it seems like for the 15-inch MacBook Air, I assume those limitations will continue to be the case. But maybe for the M3, they'll do something better.
Indeed. All right. And then Ryan Maxwell wrote in, Marco dismissed the idea pretty strongly that Apple would intentionally cripple the MacBook Air to segment the product lines and try to upsell users, which for the record, I agreed with. My first Mac was an iBook G4. And one of the main differences between an iBook and a PowerBook G4 was that the PowerBook supported extending your desktop to an external display. The iBook just supported mirroring. The problem was the iBook G4 was totally capable of supporting extending. It was just a firmware lock. There was a very popular utility that many of us used to unlock the feature. It worked great. I can imagine such hacks are much harder these days. We'll put a couple of links to relevant information in the show.
A couple people have this story. Some people thought it was iBook G3 or G4. This is back in the days when the pro laptops were called PowerBooks. It's not that Apple has never done this and it's, you know, they would never do it. It's just not common practice. I mean, the, you know, giving this example from the days of the iBook and the PowerBook shows how old it was. There's probably a couple more modern examples, but in general, that's not how Apple segments. They segment by designing the M1 chip to only have a display controller. It's like it's baked into the hardware. It makes a chip smaller, cheaper, lower power, so on and so forth. And Apple hopes that they have struck the right balance between cost and power efficiency and features. Maybe they haven't with the M1 and M2. Maybe they'll change their mind. But like that's the point at which they're making the decision. It's not like they're making a chip capable of driving 7 displays and they say, oh, but 7 displays on a MacBook Air, they would never buy our pro products. Quick, we need to cripple it. They tend not to do that. And if they do that, it's a pretty terrible mistake because that means when they were designing the chip, they made the wrong choice, right? Like if that's part of their design that we want to segment the line and give people a reason to upgrade, they would bake that into the hardware because then they would give you a smaller and cheaper chip, the two things that Apple cares about. And yes, also more power efficient, which customers care about. So, you know, that sometimes Apple makes the wrong choice with hardware, but the wrong choice for you might be the right choice for somebody else.
With regard to Final Cut Pro and the iPad, Chris writes, my 1 terabyte 13-inch M1 iPad Pro has 16 gigs of RAM and virtual memory, so the inability to round trip projects is definitely not a hardware issue. For what it's worth, not every M1 iPad Pro has 16 gigs of RAM. They can come with as quote-unquote little as 8. And then I don't know what the virtual memory story is on iPad OS. I know that that's a relatively new development, but I can't recall the specifics. John, do you happen to remember?
Yeah, I just want to add that M1, the minimum amount of RAM, I believe, is 8 gigs. I don't think Apple has ever sold it with less than 8 gigs. So if you've got an M1, you've got 8 gigs, and you may have more. The reason I put the virtual memory note in here is because I said it on last week's show, and we talked about it again. It's become the sort of colloquial way to talk about this topic. But, you know, this is a tech show, and I'll hold on to this one as long as I can. iPads have always had virtual memory forever. What they haven't had is they didn't use swap. They wouldn't take things out of RAM and swap them to, you know, flash storage and back. Those are two different things. Virtual memory just means that the addresses that your program is using are not addresses in RAM. They are virtual addresses that are somewhere in a virtual address space. And every process gets its own gigantic virtual address space of a given size. And it's like, well, how can every single process in the computer have the same address space? Aren't they stomping over each other memory? No, because those aren't the real addresses. Those are virtual addresses. And there's a thing, there's a bunch of hardware in there that translates from virtual addresses to hardware addresses. And at that point, the hardware and the operating system makes sure that two processes don't stomp on each other by using the same physical address. So basically all systems that run Darwin, the core of what was Mac OS X, have and always have had virtual memory, but iOS devices and iPad OS for the longest time did not have swap, which meant that when RAM was getting close to being exhausted, they would say, oh, don't worry about it. This stuff that's in RAM, I'll write it to quote-unquote disk in a big giant file. And if someone needs it again, I'll go get it from there. And to make room for it, I'll take something that is in RAM and put it back there. And anyway, doing that a lot is called swapping. That is called the swap file. And iPad OS did not have that for a long time, but now does support it on certain hardware configurations. I'm not familiar with details, just like Casey. We talked about when it rolled out, but I only imagine it'll become more prevalent. But the point is, it's not a limitation. The big beefy iPads do support swap. I just want to be a little bit careful about saying they support virtual memory because maybe I'll lose that battle. Maybe just eventually people will just, well, when you say virtual memory, you don't mean virtual memory. I don't think so, though, because the problem is they've always had virtual memory and there's no other word for virtual memory than virtual memory.
Yeah.
Like, well, they've always had it.
But I feel like, you know, okay, virtual memory has been supported since like the 386. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's the kind of thing you have to say that modern computers support or don't support. Every computer supports virtual. Like, most people's, like, fridges probably support virtual memory at this point. Like, so that's not...
But there's no other name for it, though.
It's like saying, yeah, my computer supports, you know, math. Yeah, that's most computers.
I know, but
if you
were trying to reuse that term, say my computer can do addition, it's like, well, I don't mean addition. I mean it'll take memory and write it out to persistent storage. I'm like, well, that's totally different. Why are you using that term? Anyway, I would say it doesn't have swap, doesn't use swap, virtual memory with swap. I don't even know how Apple describes it in their thing, but I believe they
called it virtual memory swap when they had it on one of those bubble words on the slide.
Some technical person said, you can't just call it virtual memory. You got to put the word swap. Virtual memory swap. I think that 3-word phrase, use that one. That one works. But virtual memory, it's really confusing for me to hear people say, does your iPad support virtual memory? I'm like, yeah, it does.
And so does yours. Time. And so do all of them ever. Exactly. And so does your watch.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And your fridge, probably.
Yep.
All right, so bringing you back to Final Cut Pro, I thought this feedback was excellent, and I probably should have known this having had a brief window of time when I sort of kind of knew Final Cut Pro, but because my usage was so rudimentary, I never really put this together. So Brendan writes, as an occasional Final Cut Pro user for over a decade, I'm extremely confident that the lack of round trip has nothing to do with performance whatsoever, and everything with the way Final Cut Pro 10 handles project files. It's extremely flexible and allows assets, proxies, and cached renders to be segmented out on different volumes and storage types. That is extremely useful and necessary in professional video editing environments. So I don't see a new project format coming along soon on the Mac side to replace that if it needs to adhere to the current limitations of iPadOS. So in other words, like one of the things, and maybe one of you can have a better explanation here, but one of the things that we needed a lot more years ago was if you're working with these like super high resolution video files, that's really computationally intensive for the computer to do as you're, scanning through them and so on and so forth. So the Final Cut Pro would make these quote unquote proxy files, which basically means it'll downsample, your 4K video to like 720p that it'll use for the purposes of doing the edits and getting everything lined up. And then when you finally did the one true export, it'll go back to the source material and render it in 4K or what have you. And that was proxy media, or I forget what they call it, proxy something or other. And there's all sorts of other things too. And yeah, Final Cut Pro will often generate this on its own behind the scenes, and you can be explicit if you so choose and tell it, oh, I want the proxy media to go here. I want the regular stuff to go there and so on and so forth. So yeah, I think Brendan makes a good point that it is extremely flexible, which is wonderful, particularly if you're working on like a 2-hour video or something like that. But that might not be so wonderful if you're trying to work within the extreme limitations of iPadOS.
See, I don't buy this as a format difference, though, because that's true between Macs as well. If you have a project file that references assets that are all over the place and you give that to somebody else on a Mac and they're on their laptop across the country and they try to open that project, it's not going to work because it's not going to be able to find all the media. Like, that's just the nature of the beast. I don't think there's anything particular in iPadOS that prevents access to network storage or whatever. But again, Apple makes the operating system so they could patch these things. I think if there was a new project format on the Mac, it would, of course, continue to support that flexibility, probably. And then they could also support it on iPadOS, and it would behave exactly the same way as it does on a Mac, where it says, oh, you open this project, I don't know where the hell any of this media is. I tried to connect to the server, but it's not accessible on my network. I don't know where it is. Sorry. Like, that's the nature of complicated formats like this. So it is another thing to consider, that dealing with that on iPadOS may be slightly more difficult because of sandboxing and the inability to mount network drives, as far as we know. But, Apple does make the OS, and they can make all that possible. So it's still a little bit of a mystery. I would love to hear a technical explanation from somebody at Apple why the project format is different. I would hope they wouldn't say, the iPad is a little less, like sort of just a vague answer that doesn't tell us anything. Because they can't, I don't think Apple can say with a straight face, is kind of the point of this fall. I don't think they can say with a straight face anymore that it's a power limitation, especially for the people with like a 16 gig iPad Pro with an M1. And it, like, no, there's no excuse for it in terms of horsepower or power that, and swap, right? Virtual memory swap, as Apple would say. It's got it all, right? So what's the problem? I continue to hope, fingers crossed, that it is just an updated project format that will eventually come to the Mac. And if and when it does, to Brendan's point, it will have to support all the existing workflows, just if they are an essential part of people's business, which I think they are.
Indeed. And then finally, I think it was like right in the beginning of the year, I forget exactly when it was, but Dell announced their own kind of knockoff version of the Pro Display XDR. You might remember this because it had a truly enormous webcam that stuck up above the top forehead of the monitor. If memory serves, it had a little drop down like a connectivity port that would come off the bottom of the monitor, which I actually think was kind of cool, but I'm not sure many share that opinion with me. But anyways, this is a 32-inch 6K monitor, the oh-so-eloquently named the U3224KB. Well, apparently pricing has been released, and it is $3,200, which normally would make me do a spit take, but remind me how much your ridiculously overpriced monitors were, gentlemen.
Well, are you including the stand?
Yeah, yes, don't forget, this comes with a stand. So it's $3,200, comes with a height-adjustable stand, and this thing has, to remind everybody, up to 140 watts of power delivery, a 4K webcam, a huge array of ports, just a ton of ports all over it, has slightly higher resolution than the XDR. It's 6144 by 3456 instead of the XDR's 6016 by 3384. Sorry about the way I read that number. Just deal with it. They're also, because this is Dell, we'll put a link to the product page. They make a whole line of these monitors, and you can change tons of things about them. This monitor is available in the following sizes and inches: 24, 27, 30, 32, 34, 38, 43, and 49 inches.
Well,
and
but it goes slow down, up, though. But that doesn't necessarily mean 6K in all of them.
Right, exactly. And it goes up to 8K as well. So the smaller monitors are different resolutions, and the bigger monitors can be different. But I'm saying this is the matrix of different features. So you can't get all the resolutions at all the sizes, obviously. But there's a lot of choices here, like I said, including up to 8K. I think the 8K version is like $4,000 or something. Now, this is not really an XDR quote-unquote replacement, because I don't think any of the combinations of sizes and resolutions support HDR up to 1600 nits. I don't know if they have mini LED backlights. But hey, $3,200 for XDR resolution, if you don't care about HDR, and you don't mind looking at what is a very unattractive monitor, in my opinion, it's a good deal. That's what we were worrying about, you know, wondering about the whole time. We were talking about this at CES. We were making fun of the looks. We were looking at all the ports. We're like, well, how much is this going to cost? And the question was, how much will it undercut the XDR by? And I think $3,200 with adjustable stand is a good price. Like, that is a way better deal than the XDR.
Well, you said you have a lot of options available here, but none of those options make it super nice, as you know, as an Apple replacement.
There is no option for beauty on this monitor.
Yes. So I think this is a very good deal relative to what else is in the market, which, as far as I know, is just the XDR, like in this kind of resolution and size class. I don't think there's anything else, really. I could be wrong, but I'm not aware of any.
I mean, I'm sure there are other makers making monitors with the same panel, but Dell is a reputable brand, and you know what I mean. So
yeah, but I think so. For this to be $3,200 and the XDR to be, with the stand, $6,000, yeah, this is a really good deal. I would at least, though, I would caution people, if it's been a while since you've used an Apple computer with a third-party monitor, the experience is not always as seamless as you would hope it should be. It's not like the olden days, because the olden days things were simpler. We didn't have things like HDR and all these like new DRM schemes for, you know, movie protection and stuff like that. So, you know, on some level, like I am not tempted by this. Obviously, I already have the XDR, so that's a huge difference. But I'm not tempted by this because my experiences with my ultra fine LG monitor have been pretty, you know, paper cutty. In part because the ultra fine is just such a mediocre monitor. But also in part because Apple does not seem to take much effort at all in making the experience good for third-party monitor users. And oftentimes, as Apple's computers move forward, as the hardware and software move forward, oftentimes it seems like the number of paper cuts that you get by using a third-party monitor is increasing over time. So while you are able to save a good amount of money going with this option, you are giving up a lot of niceness, and you're setting up for possible paper cut issues that you might not get with a first party monitor. And that's not to say that Apple is, you know, making the best monitors here. You know, it's just to say the reality of the situation is you're in an integrated environment if you're using this for the Mac, and you're going to miss out on some of those integrations. And there might be annoyances or limitations by going with this that we don't really know about yet, or that you might not be thinking of that are worth considering when you're making a decision.
I think a lot of the fault is going to lie with the monitor maker. That's why I was suggesting maybe Dell over somebody else, because I think there is like driver software that you might have to install on your Mac to get all the features of this monitor to work. And that's kind of the responsibility of the third-party monitor maker. You would hope Apple would work together with them better. But that is you know, it's like, who's to blame here? Is it Apple because they don't care about making stuff work with third-party monitors? Or is it the third-party monitor maker because they stopped caring about the drivers for macOS after a few years because they've already made their money on that monitor and they don't care who already bought it? To give one, I don't know if this is an example that, you know, puts Apple in a good light, but it is something that happened. Before Apple sold monitors, besides the XDR, or even maybe before the XDR, the M1 and M2, for example, even though they can only drive one monitor, they can drive the LG 5K, I believe, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
And so the LG 5K is a third-party monitor. It was the only, you know, Apple Retina resolution third-party monitor for a long time while we were asking for Apple to make one again other than the XDR.
There was the 4K for a while, and then they changed it, which made it slightly less Retina-y, but it was the LGs, the two LGs, the 4K mm-hmm. and the 5K.
Yeah, I guess the 4K 24-inch was close to that. But anyway, the 5K was the big one, right, until mm-hmm, Apple, you know, mm-hmm. Apple had the XDR, but until Apple came out with Studio Display. And the LG 5K is weird and requires Apple to do some stuff to support that Apple did. Like, as far as I'm aware, you didn't have to install any LG drivers, right, for the LG 5K?
Correct.
That's correct.
So, part of that, you could say, okay, well, that's not Apple doing it out of the goodness of their heart. It's because the LG 5K is basically the same monitor that was in a 5K iMac, and they had already done the work for that. But the fact is that the, you know, M1, when it first came out, could drive a third-party monitor, and Apple had to do some work to make that happen. Because for people who don't know, we talked about it when the 5K iMac first came out, which was ages ago. The 5K iMac, in fact, Apple bragged about it. That's why we knew about it. The 5K iMac had its special, you know, Apple custom timing controller, because it's basically like two internal logical displays with like two parallel display stream things going in there and then a controller that synchronizes them. That's how you get 5K resolution over one cable internal to the 5K iMac.
Well, that was true at the time. It is a little bit different now, but carry on. Yes.
But I think the LG 5K today, if you connect it to an M1 over a single cable, it's doing the display stream multiplexing. It's more commonplace now. But Apple had to support that, my point is, with the M1. They could have chose not to support it because none of their monitors do stuff like that, or maybe just the XDR or whatever. So I don't know. Again, I don't know if that is Apple making an effort to say, oh, well, since we don't sell any monitors like this, we should make sure the LG 5K works because it's the only game in town. Or just saying, well, we already basically did that work for the 5K iMac, so we get it for free, so we might as well do it. But it is a thing that happened. The Dell ones, on the other hand, especially the 6K thing with the camera and all the ports, I imagine you're going to be relying on Dell keeping its drivers and software up to date to have all the features of that monitor working. How good is Dell at doing that? Probably better than some random no-name brand that you just found online, right? But maybe not as good as you want it to be, to Marco's point, especially years down the line.
Yeah, it's still Dell at the end of the day. And Dell also, you know, they're not going to care nearly as much about how it works on a Mac than they are how it works on their PCs that they sell. So
I thought I saw the word Mac mentioned on the product page, so let me search for it again.
I mean, you know, they'll take our money, but, you know, you better believe they're not going to, like, you know, have amazing driver support if they don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm just happy to see the word mentioned. This monitor is compatible with multiple operating systems, including Windows and macOS, though, are in a circle. I guess, what are the other ones? Linux? But anyway, they are at least mentioning it. So I think they understand who would want a monitor with this kind of pixel density at this size. There is some possibility that it might be a Mac user.
Yep, that's fair. All right, what do we have to talk about tonight?
Well, first we can talk about whether I use this phrase correctly in the topic thing. I shouldn't be asking you to. Maybe we can get some young people in the chat to weigh in. What I wrote as the top topic here is WWDC vibe check. My use of that term is in the sense that we are seeing how we all kind of feel about WWDC being 2 weeks out from it. Is that the correct use of the term vibe check? Do we have, and we don't have any young, who are we kidding? There are no young people in the chat room.
Yeah, all
I don't know why I'm thinking this. Like, who's tuning into
a, like, is our audience old enough to think that we are using it correctly? Whether or not we actually are.
Well put.
So here's the thing. I know young people listening to the podcast. Hello out there. We love that you listen to it. Tell your friends. Tell your nerdy friends, which is what I always say. Because if you tell your regular friends, they're going to listen and think it's super weird. But tell your nerdy friends. Anyway, but people who listen live, like, there's a very tiny number of dedicated people who are in our chat room right now who listen to the live stream of this as we record it.
And we
I
love
have
them.
To imagine, because the number is so small, the percentage that might be young people there is probably very low.
Yeah,
that is probably accurate. But I will say, as an official old, I do believe you are using the term correctly. And yes. So
again, I don't know how much stock I put in any of our opinions. Agreed. Using it correctly.
Yep. Totally. Yeah. Totally.
I mean, I do have teenagers, so I feel like I have a leg up on you two at least. Yep. But I can just learn through osmosis by hearing them say things. But
well, no, who's less likely to know about cool slang? Like a random, 40 whatever year old or a 40 whatever year old with teenage children. I almost think the people without the teenage children are more likely to get it right because the teenagers will try harder to hide it from you when they're your kids.
Oh my
gosh. No, you can't help it. You'll see when you have a teenager, you can't help but hear them speak all the time and them talk to their friends, and they will say things to you using the same language they talk to their friends, whether they mean it or not.
I mean, look, we get some of that now, but like it's funny, like so going around, my kid and his friends going around that group is this. I don't know. I'm sure it came from a YouTuber, but some kind of joke where they are like, what's 9 plus 10, like 27 or whatever, and everyone laughs. It's like okay, and I don't get it at all. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm already at the point where, the kids are doing stuff that I don't understand at all that, every generation goes through this. I'm thinking like, when we start saying things like vibe check, like I'm already so disconnected from what the young kids are saying and what they think is funny and whatever references they're making from their YouTube celebrities they follow. There is no way in hell that we're using this term correctly. Like, we're too old. They're, like, we should avoid anything that even seems like modern slang. We should just stick with the phrases that are licensed for old people use.
Yeah, someone in the chat room says that the idea is that you're checking to see how somebody's doing, or like checking in with them. I don't know. I'll ask my kids after. Anyway, I've defined the term as we're using it here. If we're using it wrong, at least you know what we mean, because the goal is communication. Although I will say, what I remember on a recent episode, I heard Casey say something that I actually talked to my daughter about, that I'm wondering where Casey heard it. He probably heard it from the same place my daughter did, with some kind popular media or like a sitcom or, something.
Oh,
that,
no.
that
I'm getting so scared.
You did the, you used the term, you were, I don't know. One of my phrases that I would use for it is so on and so forth, et cetera. Sort of one of those where you're trying to say, and other things like this, I'm not going to list them all. You know what I'm talking about, right? And the phrase you use is whatever, whatever. You say whatever twice. So whatever, obviously, was from our generation. We all know about whatever, my generation anyway. Whatever, Gen X, it's totally a thing, right? Whatever, whatever. Saying it in that particular way, whatever, whatever. Whatever, I can't, I heard my daughter say it, and I talked to her, and I said, is whatever, whatever, is that a you thing, or is that a common like thing among
I have
people
no idea
your age? And she said, no, it's not a me thing. It's just a thing that people my age say. And so, took her word for it. And then I heard Casey say it a few times. Like,
did I?
Yeah. Where did Casey pick up whatever, whatever? So it must
now
be somewhere.
I want to know.
I don't think you picked up from your kids. Do either one of your kids say whatever, whatever when relaying a story about something?
I don't think so, no.
So it's probably from like, some television show or something like that.
People
keep comparing it to yada yada and saying yada yada, like that Seinfeld that made up that thing yada yada. Seinfeld did not make up yada yada. People, Seinfeld popularized it for the rest of the world that's not in the metro New York area, but rest assured, yada yada existed long before Seinfeld.
Well, this has been Language Corner, but yeah, so let's talk about how we feel about WWDC, however you want to phrase that. How we feeling? Since I'm talking, I guess I'll just start. I am excited. I never get any concrete information about anything in any regard from any of the people I know inside Apple. But I can tell you that the impression I get from
Vibe. I think we all understand and know how to use Vibe. I think that's a thing that predates a lot of teenagers who are alive today.
All right, fair enough. The vibe from people inside Apple is that they are like vibrating, like they are real excited. At least that's the impression I've gotten. I wish I could tell you that I'm being coy and I know exactly what's happening and when it's happening, so on and so forth. I genuinely know nothing, but
our sources aren't that good.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Here's the thing: the people you know and like the vibe you're getting from people at Apple, they probably don't know anything either, right? That's the thing that a lot of people who are new to the world of Apple might not understand. When we're watching some kind of presentation and Apple's presenting something, the vast majority of the Apple employees are just as surprised as we are because they compartmentalize everything. If you don't need to know about Project XYZ, you don't know about it. And so it's not like we're watching and they're like, well, every Apple employee already knows this. No, every Apple employee does not know this. So if Apple employees are vibrating, they could be coming off the same thing that we are, which is like, that's we fair. Feel like there's something big coming. And they literally don't know what it is because they're not disclosed, as they say, on the headset or on the car or on the whatever the hell. Like they don't, they literally don't know. But because they are employees and work there, you can kind of get a feel from, because maybe they know someone who does work on that team, or they know someone who knows someone, and those people seem happy all the time, or they seem frantic all the time.
Or, yeah, they've been working nonstop for the last 2 months. You know?
Exactly. Like, that's the vibe that they're getting that we're not getting, and that is being transferred to us.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite example of this is, you know, after the Swift announcement in, like, 14 or whenever it was, I was talking to a handful of internal Apple people, and of the, I don't know, 5 or 10 people I spoke to, I think maybe one or two of them was aware that that Apple was working on a new language to release at some point, but I don't think a single one of them knew that the Swift announcement was happening that day. So they're sitting there, you know, in their office or whatever, watching the keynote and saying, "Oh, that's cool." You know, at the same time that I'm looking over at John saying, "Oh, that's cool." Like, they all found out at the exact same moment for something as big as Swift. So, I mean, not literally all of them, but you know what I'm saying. So, whatever, John.
For the Swift example specifically, that's another example of how tricky it is to read the tea leaves at Apple. Way back in the day, you know, I'd written a bunch of blog posts at Ars Technica, which have since been moved to my own website, talking about Apple's needs for a new programming language. And in response to those posts, lots of people from Apple either reached out to me, back channeled, I talked to them at WWDC, and we would have discussions on the topic that I wrote about. Obviously, almost all of them didn't know anything about what Apple would eventually do in this area. Some of them did, right? And we would have discussions about it. And in hindsight, I can see that a lot of those discussions, you could tell which one of these people that I was talking about this 4 years before Swift was announced knew Swift existed or whatever, you know, or like whatever, 2 years, 1 year leading up to it. That's the way that you can get a vibe from Apple people. The problem is, though, tons of stuff is happening inside Apple that never sees the light of day. And so you can have a discussion with somebody that makes you, I totally think from all these discussions I've been having with Apple people, they seem really excited about whatever, smell-o-vision, right? And I really think Apple's working on a smell-based product, and it just never sees the light of day. And you're like, oh, I guess I was wrong about that. And then you have to learn 15 years later that there was a big smell-o-vision project and it got canned because of some internal political turf war, or they decided they weren't going to do smell-o-vision. Or
it was,
like,
catching on fire.
Right, exactly. So the vibe inside Apple reflects a feeling about what might be happening inside Apple. But then there's the question, okay, but what of the things that happens inside Apple comes out of Apple, and in what form and when? Another example is the TV stuff. Apple's going to make a television set. And like from what we understand from current rumors and people revealing stuff, some of the technology that was originally made for the project where Apple was going to make a television set, I keep saying television set because I don't know how to explain this to young people, but like a TV, a big screen that you look at that plays, anyway. Ended up in the HomePod of all places, because they were working on audio for the HomePod. So the HomePod comes out of some work that was done in the television. There was so much smoke around TV back in the day of just like, Apple's going to make a television set, they're going to do it, it's going to be. And what we ended up getting was the HomePod and the Apple TV, and Apple never did make a television set. And we'll see where the car stuff goes. So it's difficult to read, but sometimes like the vibe you're getting, it's a legit vibe, even if Apple never ships any of that stuff in the form you think they're going to. But in this case, I feel like the vibe about the headset is so strong and so lightning focused and so detailed with the rumors that, where there's smoke, there's surely going to be fire eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, again, I'm not playing coy. I wish I knew, and I was playing coy, but I'm not. But I don't know. I just feel like, based on no facts and just a gut feeling, I feel like there's going to be a lot this year. Even if it isn't the headset, I still feel like it's going to be a busy keynote. Obviously, the drop of Final Cut Pro and Logic Pro just last week, that could, you know, lend credence to the idea that it's going to be busy. But I don't know. I feel like there's going to be a lot here. And
if there's no headset, how can it be busy? Explain that to me.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I really don't know. But I mean, there, as a couple of examples off the top of my head, it sounds like we're getting an all new Watch OS, or for some loose definition of all new, which we may or may not talk about this episode. We should be getting widget support on iPad OS. Trying to think of other things. Presumably there'll be a lot of improvements to Swift UI. I mean, this is a developer conference, strictly speaking. So hopefully we'll see a lot of Swift UI improvements. I'm not sure. I feel like they could fill an hour to an hour and a half with just normal software stuff. I mean, hell, as Chris Finazzo says in the chat, a no new features in macOS, that would need an hour and a half just for applause, right?
That would be a crowd pleaser, but I don't know if it would count as a big keynote. I kind of feel like headset is the obvious one that would make this big. And honestly, if they have the headset, nothing else matters, essentially. Like, not that they're not, of course they're gonna have new versions of all their OSs, and the new versions will have nice features, but if they have the headset, that alone makes it an extremely, like, these come rarely. When does Apple introduce new platforms? Not that often. WatchOS, tvOS, like, they, you know, sometimes they're big, sometimes they're small, but this is so hyped, so long rumored, it's as if they were coming out with the car, right? All you need is that. If that exists in the keynote, it is a big keynote. If that isn't released in this keynote, I think to make it a big keynote, you need a lot of things that currently seem unlikely. I think you would need the 15-inch MacBook Air to be announced. You need all new versions of the OSs with some significant features that people care about. And I think you'd have to probably throw in the Mac Pro. That's what it would take to match the headset. And
it always comes back to the Mac Pro.
But
with you,
honestly, no one cares about the Mac Pro but me. But if you're trying to make a big keynote, you need the things people do care about. 15-inch MacBook Air, all new versions of all the operating systems that people love, Swift with the new features, new version of Xcode, and then you throw in the Mac Pro as a, you know, fun kicker. If you remember, when the Mac Pro was announced at WWDC, we were all there, I believe. The 2019 Mac Pro, that is. Mm-hmm. And I think that was like the star of the show in terms of, didn't they like leave that to the end? Like, despite the fact that nobody buys them or whatever, it is a glamour product for Apple to roll out because it's big, it's powerful, it's shiny, it's expensive, it's good looking if you like holes. right. And so I know people think like, oh, nobody cares about the Mac Pro, that doesn't make a big keynote. It does. It would add to the bigness of it, but you need all that stuff that I described. And on the other side of the scale, just the headset by itself.
Yeah, that's fair. But I don't know. I've been talking a long time, but suffice to say, I get the feeling that whatever it is, it's going to be a big year. Which is why I really hope that the three of us get to be there. So Apple, call us. We'd love to hear from you. But no, I think it's going to be big. And I think that would be excellent because I don't feel like the last couple of years have been bad by any means, but I think just a really firing on all cylinders kind of year would be pretty, pretty awesome.
Yeah. I feel like I'm excited. You know, I'm a little bit nervous for as a developer that, like, I'm about to have my summer, you know, ruined in the best way. You know, the same way it's like, you know, like that Jonathan Colton song about, you know, you ruined everything in the nicest way. Like, when you have a kid, it's like, oh, you ruin everything in the nicest way because you disrupt my life in a huge way, but you know you're my kid and I love you. Forgive the horrendous summarizing of this, you know, art form. I feel like this might be like that for developers in the sense that, like, whatever plans we had for this year are probably about to be derailed in a pretty big way by the headset. You know, it seems, by all accounts, it seems like the headset is being announced at this event. And there's going to be a developer story to it, because obviously why else would they announce it if that'd be quite a move at a developer conference to be like, here's a brand new platform.
You would have a sweet solution. You can make web apps for it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. So anyway, yeah, you can program it only with Siri.
Oh, gosh.
I would quit the business. Anyway, so I think our plans are going to be disrupted if our plans weren't, you know, wait for the headset. It's going to be disruptive. And I think it's going to be in a very exciting way. I don't know what the headset will be. I don't know what the headset's chances are in the market. But, you know, when I use the existing VR headset hardware that exists, you know, on the market today, the limited amount I have used with it, although, you know, with the exception of the Oculus, whatever, 2 that we have upstairs, I'm super uninterested in it, and it kind of gives me motion sickness a little bit. It doesn't work optically well with my eyes for whatever reasons. There's a lot of, like, minor paper cuts or major paper cuts with it, and I don't find the games that interesting. But Apple is full of really smart nerds, and many of them have apparently decided that what they have is something special and worth shipping for Apple in a pretty high-profile way. So I'm optimistic. I'm tentatively optimistic that whatever they have is probably pretty good, because I trust them to make that call, and they call it right most of the time. So whatever they have, you know, we can look around the market and we can be super unexcited about all the other VR headsets out there, and also trust Apple to say, you know what, if they're this excited about something like this and they're thinking and they're releasing it now, there's probably something there. It's probably really good in at least some ways for at least some uses and possibly more. So, you know, because otherwise they wouldn't be releasing it. You know, Apple holds back on a lot of stuff. So we can be fairly sure that what does get out there, especially a new platform in a high-profile release like this is, you know, bound to be, they've done their homework. They've probably built something really cool, and it's probably going to be really exciting when we see it. So that's why I'm very interested, not in the VR or AR or XR space in general. I'm very interested in what the heck did Apple do here, because I trust them to, if they've gotten to this point, it's probably something really exciting and really good. Now, how many other people will think so and will be willing to spend $3,000 and, you know, deal with the whole, you know, butt-mounted battery situation? You know, who knows? We'll see when we get there. But again, I trust them.
If they
to
do that, I don't think that'll
right.
be a thing to deal with. By the way, I think that'll be a feature that everyone will say, "Oh, of course they did it." I mean, we've all discussed all the reasons. It's just that once the product comes out, all the reasons we've discussed suddenly become like concrete, and people say, "I always thought it was a good idea because right. the headset weighs less, and you can swap batteries, and so on and so forth." But right now, everyone thinks it's dumb.
Right, and then the whole rest of the industry will change to butt batteries, and they'll be like, "Well, of course, this is the obvious
exactly,
design.
Right.
We didn't copy
Apple."
It
was obvious. We didn't copy Apple. Yeah. I mean, Apple's not going to be the first one to use a battery pack, external battery pack. A bunch of other people, not anyway. Yeah. I do feel like for the headset, again, I get the vibe that it's coming this year. If it's not, I think a lot of people will be disappointed. I think it's, you know, whatever. Like, it would, quote unquote, justifiable. It's like, well, Apple never announced anything. That was all on you. It was just rumors. But anyway, the good thing that I hope the headset will do is provide cover for every other product. And I know this is not the way it works inside Apple, but like, it's plausible that there could be enough internal communication to let the other products that are announced every WWDC, all the new versions of the new OS, the new version of Swift, updates and frameworks, the new version of Xcode, gives them some cover to not feel like they have to press to get their exciting feature out the door ASAP, even if it's buggy, because the headset is just going to block out the sun at WWDC, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of times at WWDC, I feel some groups are pressing. They're like, we really need to wow them in the keynote, and they show something and we are wowed, but then we realize like, oh, this isn't even in the beta build at WWDC. It'll be coming in a later build, and when it does come, it's buggy and unfinished, and it just ends up being frustrating and disappointing. And it's like, you don't need to try that hard. Ship what you're actually ready to ship. Like, I don't want to see anything in any of the other sort of platform stuff that isn't in the WWDC beta, because I feel like the headset provides them cover to be more relaxed with their, with their choice of what to include and what to save for a future release. In the ideal world, I would have liked, you know, Apple to have the forethought to say, hey, back in 2022, hey, WWDC 2023, we're going to ship the headset. So everybody else, when you're planning your new releases for the new versions of all the different OSs, everybody take a Snow Leopard, right? That didn't happen. Like, that's, that they don't have that kind of coordination. They can't tell the future that far in advance. It's foolhardy to try to make plans like that. I do think it would be wise for them to give each platform a Snow Leopard once in a while. We've talked a lot about macOS not being annual, if they could get the bugs out of it, but it's just too big of a company to be that coordinated and making plans that far in advance about software releases and releases and headset. Most of, you know, the part of the reason you can't make that plan is that all the other groups aren't even probably disclosed on the headset if they don't have to be, or subsets of them are, because only some people who work on tvOS don't have to know about the headset. Not all the people, and certainly the people who work on tvOS hardware probably don't need to know about it. Anyway, it's very compartmentalized to the detriment of Apple internally, I feel like, sometimes. And this is kind of one of those cases that we just assume that, despite the fact that if the headset does launch at WWDC, it will provide cover for lots of other OSs, the only thing that helps them with is what I just described, which is, okay, now maybe they don't have to press. Maybe the higher levels of the org chart cannot press to have the Xcode team, you know, push out some feature of Xcode that is buggy and going to cause the app to crash all the time. They'll say, we'll just save that to next year. It's fine that you don't have it. And they won't know that's because the headset is coming, but only like the people 7 levels off the org chart who are disclosed in the headset do know that. And they let those things travel downhill. This, I know this sounds Byzantine and complicated, but honestly, this is the way it works in big companies, especially ones like Apple that have everything compartmentalized. That's why reading the tea leaves is a thing. This whole kind of game of telephone of like, what gets prioritized, what gets given money, and why, by people who at various points in the chain don't know, have all the information available. They just know what the people above them tell them and what the people below them send back and feedback. But they don't. Nobody has the whole picture until you get pretty high in the org chart. And it makes it very difficult to act in a coherent manner. Apple has an amazing job of it, to be clear. As a company, they speak with one voice. Their marketing, their PR makes it seem like they are a coherent mass, but internally it's lots of little kingdoms moving in all sorts of different directions, pushed and pulled by forces they can't see and don't understand for the most part.
Yeah.
Apple can put that slogan in their recruiting material.
Yeah, very promising. Yeah, so in terms of like the overall, like what I expect from the other platforms, you know, it's hard when in a new platform year, like what we have most likely here with the headset launching. This is a year, as John mentioned, like this doesn't happen often. This is a year of a new platform. What tends to happen with Apple when a new platform is being developed is a bunch of talent is pulled from other teams to work on that new thing. And obviously it doesn't all just happen in one year. But what has probably happened here is probably a bunch of people from other OSs and other projects in the company have probably been spending a lot of time recently working on the headset. And so I would expect, based on that, for not only this year, but also last year, to have been somewhat slow. And I would say that's kind of the case. You know, that being said, Apple's a bigger company now than they used to be, and they are able to maintain things on multiple fronts better than they used to be. They're still not great at it, but they're way better than they used to be. But anyway, so I would expect this to be a somewhat slow year for the other platforms. But that being said, in terms of like what is actionable for developers to do with the headset right now, I think, you know, we're going to see version 1.0 of this OS. We're going to see version 1.0 of the SDK and version 1.0 of all the frameworks and the UI and everything else. On some level, it's very exciting and very disruptive to our summers, as I was saying earlier. But also, there might just not be that much for us to do yet on it. You know, first of all, I don't know when they plan to actually ship this thing to us, but that's going to itself be a pretty big limitation. Like, there's going to be a lot of things where we want to develop something for this, but we kind of can't until we have one. Or we can only do preliminary work, maybe in some kind of simulator or something, until we get one. Or maybe, you know, maybe Apple will use the new developer center that they built, they opened up last year, to like, you know, invite developers out by invitation only. Come out to the developer center in, you know, July and August, and you can sign up for like, you know, a 1-day slot to use the hardware and test your app on it. You know, they did that with the watch, so, you know, and they had like the whole dev kit situation with the transition to Apple Silicon. So like, they've done stuff kind of in this ballpark before, so I'm guessing that kind of thing will happen. You know, whether it will be open to many developers is a different question. You know, I'm sure some developers will get invited. You know, I don't know if it will be like anybody can sign up kind of thing. I think it'll be more likely, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. That's much more likely, just for scale. But anyway, so I don't expect there to be a ton for developers to do on the headset yet this summer, because presumably we won't have them yet. We won't have access to them yet. And we probably will have a very early SDK. So it's going to depend a lot on what you do. Like if you make an app or choose to make an app that is really a great thing in AR, VR, you know, then you're going to have maybe a busier time. If you make, say, a podcast player, you know, it might not be that important. Like it might just be, all right, find a way to show a UI, but otherwise everything else is the same. And if the stories are accurate about, like, you know, them being able to run iPad apps in little windows, it might not be that much work at all for developers to get their apps to at least run on the thing. And then, you know, once we have physical access to them, then we can maybe worry about, you know, making it good on the thing. Secondly, if we don't have physical access to them, neither do our customers. And so, again, it's like there's only going to be so much we can really do until this thing is out in the market, or at least widely available to developers. So that's going to hold back some of that. So I would also hope that there is some nice-to-haves on the other platforms. This is what we're going to get to in a second. And I think based on the rumors and everything so far, that seems fairly plausible. And also just based on, you know, what Apple has done, even when their teams have been busy doing other stuff, you know, on new platforms or whatever, they do tend to have decent iOS releases. You know, macOS oftentimes, you know, is last priority and doesn't get much. and frankly, that's often a good thing, because when they touch macOS without a ton of effort behind it, they tend to break things and make them worse. So, you know, it's good for macOS to not have a lot of updates when they're busy. But iOS, I think, is likely to have some decent quality of life stuff there. That, you know, even if there isn't some kind of massive, you know, SDK overhaul, some kind of massive new language or framework or anything else, like, even in the absence of those really big updates, there tends to be a bunch of nice small stuff with new iOS upgrades, both as customer-facing features and on the developer SDK end. A lot of little, like, quality of life improvements, little new APIs, little, you know, single little modifiers for Swift UI, or, hey, here's a new view container that makes things easier for you. You know, stuff like that, that tends to get there in every release. So I'm expecting that for iOS. And then I think what we're about to get to is, I'm actually very excited and interested to hear that there's pretty strong rumors that watchOS is getting substantial updates. So do we want to talk about that now?
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Do you want to introduce it, or should I?
Oh, hi. Hi, Future Marco. I didn't realize we were pitching to me. Sorry. Hello. All right, let's try that again. So yeah, this is reported in Bloomberg, what was this, last month, I believe, in late April. I believe it was a Mark Gurman piece that talked about how Apple is to upgrade its watch operating system with a new focus on widgets. And so Mark writes, as part of watchOS 10, Apple is planning to bring back widgets and make them a central part of the interface. The new widget system on the Apple Watch will be a combination of the old watchOS Glances system and the style of widgets that were introduced in iOS 14 on the iPhone. The plan is to let users scroll through a series of different widgets for activity tracking, weather, stock, tickers, calendar appointments, and more, rather than having them launch apps. The new interface will be reminiscent of the Siri watch face, which was introduced in watchOS 4, but it will be available as an overlay for any watch face. It's also similar to widget stacks, a feature in iOS and iPadOS that lets users pile many widgets into one and scroll through them. As part of the overhaul, Apple is testing the idea of changing the functions of some of the watch's buttons. Currently, a press of the digital crown launches the home screen. For the next version of watchOS, Apple may have that open up widgets instead. And it is worth noting that apparently the Watch App Store has fewer than a million monthly users in the whatever region they were going to through some court proceedings. Apple disclosed versus 101 million on the iPhone. So literally 100 times more people using the iOS App Store than the watchOS App Store. I can't say I'm surprised. But yeah, I mean, I think the idea of widgets on the watch is appealing. It's not, I don't know if I'm quite as enthusiastic as you are, Marco, but I will say that even as someone who has only dabbled in watch development, one of the things that makes watch development very tough, particularly for things like complications, is that you have extraordinarily little time as a developer to run code that will update information on a complication and other things like that. And so if widgets were given more flexibility and more time to update themselves such that they're getting updated more than what feels like three times a day, I know that's not literally the case, but that's what it feels like sometimes. That I would be more enthusiastic about. Like when I look down at my carrot weather widget and it's not, or excuse me, complication, and it's not carrot's fault. Oftentimes it is clearly behind, you know, especially on, you know, spring or fall days where, you know, the temperature can vary pretty dramatically from morning to afternoon. A lot of times I'll look in my watch will say, oh, it's, you know, like 40 degrees outside, but I can tell it's easily, you know, 20 degrees more than that. And so I think what I'm most potentially interested in is if there is either, you know, a better API, which presumably there would be, and I'm going to give you a chance here, Marco, in a second, but you know, a better API to make this work a little better, or be easier to do on the developer side, but more, I guess more importantly, just to have a little bit of more ability to make the watch feel alive rather than something that occasionally wakes up and then goes immediately back to sleep again. I don't know, Marco, does any of that make sense?
Yes. And I think you've identified a couple of the key parts of, you know, both why I'm excited for this, and also why, you know, some of the issues I've had with watchOS in the past and present. So Apple has a long history going back to, I believe, the first major version of this that we saw in modern day was Dashboard for macOS. A long history of these views that you can get where you have to, like, go to the view, or you look at a view of something, and at that point, when you're looking at it, the app is asked, hey, update this data. And in the meantime, maybe it shows a placeholder or stale data, and then the new data pops in, like, a second or two later. And from a user point of view, that sucks. Like, it's terrible, like, when you look at something on your watch, or in the old dashboard interface on the Mac, or different places like that, or, you know, the old Today screen, or the Today widgets on iOS, like, you would seek out this information, you would go to it, or you would look at it, and then, at that point, the system would ask the app, oh, hey, update this. And the reason why it was built that way was that these systems, for various reasons over time, there weren't the system resources, or they were chosen not to be spent this way, to have those apps constantly running in the background, being able to update their data whenever they wanted. You know, in the case on the watch has always been extremely power constrained. And that dictates everything about it. It's a very small battery and a very small device, and they really can't make the battery any bigger. It's already most of the device, so it's like it's you got to deal with what you got here, and that dictates everything. That dictates the slow processor that the watch has relative to the phone. And everything is about, like, space and power and minimizing drain on that battery.
Speaking of that, there are rumors that they're going to actually change the SoC, not just change the number on it, but actually change. And I don't see the rumors around 3 nanometer are really confusing, because I know TSMC is ramping up on 3 nanometer, but the lead times are such that I can't figure out when Apple will ship a product fabbed on TSMC's 3 nanometer process. But I also can't imagine the watch SoC being substantially better without going to a new process. The problem, I don't know what the current process is. And is it actually the same process size as the good 5 nanometer that the phones are, or is it on an older
one? It might still be 7. I mean, because the watch SoC, like the CPU in the watch, I don't know about the whole SoC, the CPU cores in the watch have not changed in 3 years.
I think the whole SoC hasn't changed. I think people who have looked at the die shots, that, like, not much has changed in it for a long time.
Yeah, so it's using a 3-year-old processor, and so that's not fun. Yeah, I think the series 6, 7, and 8, they're all the same chip. So the
rumor is this might be a new chip, and I think if it uses a smaller process size than the previous one, that could give Apple a little bit of headroom to change some of the things you just described.
Yes, because that's the thing. Like with watchOS, in like since its beginning, it was all about extremely aggressively conserving the resources on the watch, because there's not much to go around. So that impacts the way apps have been built from the beginning in various ways. But the gist of it is what Casey said, that your app you don't always run. Like if you're not being actively used on screen, with very few exceptions, you're not running. And so if you rely on a third-party app that has, say, a complication that you're looking at, say, you know, Carrot Weather, you know, a good weather app, you know, you're looking at whatever the complication is on the screen, like, that app is only being woken up in the background every so often to, you know, fetch new data from the internet, update the data in the app, and, you know, update the complication, you know, data. And it tells the watch, hey, over these next, you know, 6 hours, here's the hourly forecasted display. From this time to this time, show this. From this time to this time, show this, etc. It gives us this timeline of updates. And during that entire time, the watch may not and probably won't ever ask the app, hey, refresh, give me new data here. So what you're looking at when you look at watch complications, you are looking at a timeline of pre-rendered data that the app has provided during some, like, 3-second long window it was allowed to run in the background a few hours ago, possibly. And there's a certain limit on how many times per day it can do that. The app servers can send push notifications to request an update, but those aren't always obeyed. It's a request, not a guarantee. Like, please give me some time. I have some new stuff. I would like to show it. And the watch can say, okay, or the watch can say, I don't know what you're talking about, and just walk away. And so there's all these limitations, and the widget system on the iPhone was built the same way. if you were making watch complications, you know, a couple of years ago, then when WidgetKit came out, it was like, oh, this is ClockKit, just, you know, slightly different and with SwiftUI, mm-hmm. which made it a lot better. But that idea of when you swipe over, when you view a widget on the iPhone, that app is not running. And this is why, again, like there's also some rumors with iOS 17 of possible interactive widgets. And this kind of flies in the face of this because it's kind of questioning like, well, what would that mean? And I think it would be very limited if that is a thing. But anyway, because again, widgets on iOS work that same way. And then they later then brought that widget system back to the watch and replaced ClockKit, which was based on WidgetKit was based on the ideas of ClockKit, but did it better with SwiftUI. Then they redid the new complication system using WidgetKit because it was better. Anyway. So they brought it back full circle. Anyway, so on iOS, you know, you have widgets. Those apps aren't running. It's the same thing where they are periodically asked for updates, and the app gives iOS a timeline to say, all right, show this from this time to this time, etc. And again, same thing applies. That app servers can send a push notification requesting an update. It may or may not be obeyed. There's limits. There's throttling, etc. On iOS, there's, you know, one set of limits. On the watch, it's way more aggressively throttled, and there's way less opportunity for apps to update their complications on the watch. So anything they do, first of all, it makes perfect sense to bring that system more to the watch because it does what the watch needs. It gives a timeline of updates without having to have all these apps running in the background draining the very, very tiny battery in the Apple Watch. So it makes sense to have this be more built into the system. That being said, if there's no other major advances, like more frequent background updates, more, you know, a more robust system to request updates, higher limits on how much CPU time or memory those processes or extensions can use when they're updating, without other changes like that, it's going to be a fairly limited system. And it's not going to enable a lot of what people would expect or want. So I hope when they bring this over, assuming they have done, I mean, I'm sure it's too late now, whatever they've decided to do, that's it. But I hope they have, when they have presumably brought this over, I hope it has come with some increases in those limits or some, yep. you know, less aggressive throttling, some more frequent updates being permitted or something. And all of that, I think, will be a great thing once they establish it, because when you look at the way the watch works now, apps on the watch still suck. They just suck less than they used to. Way less. I mean, they used to be horrendous. With you know, WatchKit 1, that was rough. But, you know, they're still very limited. They're still way more limited than iOS apps. And it makes it very hard as a developer to make a great watch app experience that will match what our users expect. As a result, it's kind of unfair. You know, like I don't use a third-party weather widget on my as a complication on my watch, because third-party apps, even the best written ones, like Carrot, Carrot's a great app.
It is.
Even mm-hmm. the best written weather apps on the Apple Watch cannot update their complications as often or as reliably as Apple lets theirs update. So I use Apple weather complications on my watch, even though they're less good, because they work better and more consistently. And that's not to say anything against the developer of other apps. They can't do anything about it. It's out of their hands. And I know this, like, because I have my own custom little complications that don't do anything useful, but I just kind of use them for cosmetic, you know, things on my own face. And I know that occasionally they just stop getting asked to update, and I can't do anything about it. Like, it's so the whole system is pretty it's pretty limiting for third party developers. So what I'm hoping, if they're moving this to the system from a developer point of view, I hope those limits get raised in a big way. And maybe that'll need the new processor. Maybe not. I hope not, because I would like them to be available on all the existing install base. But hey, we'll see what happens. And then as a user of watchOS, the honeycomb screen has always been a huge failure. Anytime you have to go to that screen, you've lost. And going to that screen, it's like trying to plug in a micro USB cable. It's like, I know I'm gonna spend way too long staring at these tiny icons, trying to find the app that I want, and whatever I tap on, whatever I guess, is this alarm or timer? Whatever I guess is going to be wrong the first time, and maybe the second. And so that screen is terrible. You can change it to a list if you want by a long pressing, but the list is terrible in different ways. It's, first of all, it's just too long. There's all these different built-in features, many of which you can't turn off, that, you know, you need some way to access. So that whole system could use a rethink. It's a hard problem. I get, you know, they're trying to cram 40 apps onto a 2-inch screen. Like, yeah, it's that's a tough problem. But there is room for improvement in the way they've done it now. So if the rumor is correct that they are actually re-implementing or rethinking large parts of how users interact with apps on the watch at all, that's a very good thing too. And then finally, I would say the rate of adoption of third-party apps among non-nerd people on the watch is really low. I mean, this is just anecdotal, but, you know, look around people in your life who have Apple Watches. We've talked about that on the show before. How many of them even know that you can change the complications? Ask around. Look around. See how many people in your life use an Apple Watch face that even has complications, and then see how many of those are on the defaults. And it's a lot. It's most of them. So the watch has a lot of functionality that is just that people just don't know about. And you can't blame them, because the way to access this functionality is often really hidden or convoluted.
Or on the phone.
Yeah, or on the phone, which, I mean, fortunately, they have been moving a lot of that off. Like I recently tried to edit like what metrics were shown in different workout modes. And that used to be phone only. And now it's watch only. Now you have to like hit the little like dot menu on the workout and go in there and edit stuff there. It took me a while to figure out. Like, first I was looking all over the phone app for it. Couldn't find it anywhere there. I'm like, well, crap, did they just remove customization of workout faces? And then eventually I found it in the watch app, but it took me a while. And that was like, I know this feature is probably still here somewhere, and I know roughly where to look at it, and I'm a computer professional. And it took me a long time to figure it out. So there's a lot of stuff like that on the watch. There's a lot of functionality on the watch, much of which people would really enjoy if they knew it was there or if they knew how to do it. And it has a massive discoverability problem, and a lot of stuff is super clunky about it once you do figure it out. So there's a lot of room for improvement there. I'm really excited that they're tackling this, because for most of the last, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, it has seemed like the watch is not well staffed. Like it has seemed like when WWDC comes and goes every year for the watch, it has seemed a lot like, man, do they have like more than 4 people working on this entire OS? Like, because they, you know, they do good work, but it's just really bits and pieces come out every year. Like, it's not a lot comes out from the watch from watchOS every year. It's a very, it's kind of like tvOS. Like, you know, you get a couple of things here and there, but it's a very, very small set of new features every year. And so it has seemed underinvested in the last, you know, X years. This suggests that they have actually put a lot of effort into it this year. So that's exciting to me as well. I'm really looking forward to, hopefully, the watch having like major updates in usability or in app capabilities or app structure or whatever it is. I hope they actually deliver on that. I hope it's really good. And I would also hope, still, maybe, the more you put a widget-like architecture into the watch, I think the easier that makes it for them to offer third-party watch faces as an option.
Yeah.
Now,
okay.
Whether
it's
going
to happen eventually. Mark
whether,
my words.
Yeah. Whether they are doing it, whether they will choose to do it, whether they will permit it, these are all very different questions. But from a technical point of view, using WidgetKit or a WidgetKit-like system with some pre-built parts makes a lot of sense for the structure to enable third-party watch faces, because then you don't have to have the third-party process running constantly on the watch. You can, again, just wake it up periodically. You can define certain pieces that you have to use. Like, all right, well, you have to use this digital face of this size, and it has to be in this location. Or you can choose to use these specific analog watch hands, and they have to be in this location. You know, whatever it is, if they wanted to dictate certain parts of it and certain requirements, say all watch faces must be able to do X, Y, Z, or must use pieces XYZ in this way, they could do that really well with WidgetKit, technically speaking, and practically speaking. So it seems like the most apparent and obvious way to enable third-party watch faces based on the tech stack we know of today is with WidgetKit. So bringing WidgetKit to watchOS in a bigger way, yeah, that makes a lot of sense for maybe enabling this either now or in the future. I hope it's now. If it isn't now, and I know it probably isn't, I hope it's in the near future, because I still want third-party watch faces. And this is just such a clear, like, not, I wouldn't necessarily call anything easy, but this is such a straightforward and dare I say, obvious way to offer them, you know, using this kind of architecture. So anyway, so, I'm looking forward to this, and I hope this is an exciting year for watchOS.
So imagine this. It's WWDC. We're watching the video. Since it's a fantasy, we're all sitting next to each other for the first time since 2019. We're watching the video together, and Kevin Lynch comes on the video and says, I only have one thing to tell you about the watch. Communication between the watch and the phone is reliable now, and then walks away. Is that enough? It'll never happen. But no. Marco, is that enough to make this a classic, like, just favorite WWDC of all time?
Oh no, because I would. First of all, I don't think it's possible. Second of all, I wouldn't believe them.
That's fair.
I think the way to fix phone to watch communication is to get rid of it. Like the way to fix it is to give me the same controls that I have on URL background download sessions and URL communication, which you have most of it already. Give me the same background download abilities and APIs on the watch that I have on the phone. Let it download, like, let background download start immediately, and let them run over Wi-Fi and not over Bluetooth to the phone. That's what, like, there's a number of points in that communication stack that are either unreliable or ungodly slow. And again, this is all in the name of saving power. Like, you can see why they did it, but I think a lot of those decisions, they might have made sense 7 years ago. Maybe they make less sense now, or maybe they're not as necessary now as they used to be. And those decisions really hold back apps. And so, again, I hope they, like, just let my app initiate a backgroundable download that will run over Wi-Fi and start immediately. That's it. Yeah. I can do it on iOS. I can do it on all other Apple OSs. I don't think macOS supports background downloads. Anyway, I can do it on most other Apple OSs. I can't do it on the watch, and that really holds stuff back. To the point where I had to make a breakout game in my app so that you would keep the screen on. Like, that, the whole reason I had to make a game in my watch app, in my podcast app, while you download a file, is so that you have something to do that will keep the screen on, so I don't have to rely on the background downloads when you want to download something right now before you go out for a run or something, and you don't want it to be canceled for no reason or to never start for no reason. So please, Apple, make that stuff better. But anyway, I will complain a lot less about that if I have custom third-party watch faces.
No, that's fair. So, John, pulling on this thread a moment, what is your, I don't care about anything else that happened, this was a great WWDC, I assume, new Mac Pro?
I mean, yeah, well, I'm not really expecting that because of the rumors, although I do have a brief aside about something that Marco talked about, how people don't know, don't customize their complications on their watch because they don't know they can do it, and the interface of doing it is clunky, and it's lots of things on the watch are non-discoverable. And when you were describing that, I thought this is another place where it seems like Apple is, I mean, we don't know because we don't know what they're doing, but it seems like they're behind where everyone else is zooming forward with their large language models. One of the things that current large language models that are out there right now are really good at doing is exactly this task, which is a voice interface to describing what you want the complications in your phone screen to be like. You can go to one of these large language models right now and say, make me a web page, and in the lower left corner put a picture of a sun, and in the lower right corner put a counter that counts up every second. And, like, you could actually describe the functionality of the widgets and it will do it. Like, how easy would it be for a well-trained large language model to say, I want the weather in the upper left, the date in the lower left, and then to continue a conversation and said, no, I want the date to be the day of the week plus the month and the year, or I don't want the year. Like, those type of conversations, you can have them with large language models right now. And the canvas that they're painting on is like anything you can ask for, more or less. It'll try to do it with varying degrees. The problem space of picking which widgets you want to, picking out from a fixed set of widgets to appear in a fixed set of location with a fixed set of options, large language models would eat that for breakfast. Problems are, one, Apple seems not to be on that train with everyone else, as far as we know, because they haven't announced anything in that area. Two, their existing thing that you can talk to, Siri, sucks balls, and we know that. And then, you know, three, I don't think this is the type of thing that Apple can, say, oh, well, they're popular. We'll roll it out this year. You know what I mean? Like, it's, again, it's hard enough because we don't know what's going on. But like, it seems like Apple is behind everyone else on this. So you can't expect them to, surprise, watchOS 10 is out and it's got a large language model that you can talk to. Oh, and I guess this ties into what Marco was saying too, is even if you could, like, you don't run the large language model on the watch, right? So now it has to do network communication. Oh no, the sky is falling, batteries being destroyed. And I get that. Like it's true of what Marco was asking for. I want my download to start now and on Wi-Fi. It'll kill people's watch batteries. But it's like, but they want that to happen when they're down. They, you know, it's the balance between which would you rather have? Your podcast literally never downloads and it frustrates you to no end, or we burn part of your battery downloading your podcast. Like, you have to pick one. You can't, like, there's no way to get the podcast on your watch without burning battery. So either you want it and you're willing to sacrifice the battery for it, and you don't. And the same deal, I think, with talking to your watch and setting up with a large language model and setting up your complications. Maybe as a one-time tutorial that you guide people through when they're setting up their watch and they have a conversation with it, and during the course of the conversation, the watch face forms in front of their eyes, is a great way to, A, show people that that's possible, and B, let them know that they can do it in a way that doesn't involve them poking their fingers at the screen trying to find the interface. Because I have the same frustration. I'm not familiar with watchOS because I don't wear an Apple Watch, and anytime I want to do anything in watchOS, I don't know where it is. I don't know how it works. I can't figure out what things I'm supposed to be touching, or what even what the vocabulary of gestures is to do stuff. Large language models would destroy this task. They're so good at it. It's such a narrow problem space, and you can talk in a free-form manner. And Apple's speech-to-text actually works pretty well. So once you get over that hurdle, and you can throw that text to a large language model running somewhere on an Apple server that it can communicate with, that is, I think, a really good use of current technology for, you know, talking to things, and the problem space of dealing with any kind of UI on a 2-inch screen that's on your wrist.
Yeah, and on the point of large language models, by the way, this is obviously, you know, a huge question. It's like, we're in this like, you know, boom time of this new generation of AI capabilities. What's Apple going to do at WWDC with them? And I think, unfortunately, the answer is probably nothing. Because
I'm saying, like,
that's not what Apple does. Like, Apple does stuff, you know, more slowly than that in a lot of areas. And
I mean, they could, if they were on the ball on this and were sort of ahead of the curve, or even, you know, even with everyone else, they could have stuff to announce at WWDC. But that whole part of the org seems dysfunctional now, again, because we don't know what's going on. For all we know, they've been working on large language model stuff for 7 years and they're about to roll it out and wow us. But it certainly seems like that's not the case.
No, I think what's more likely is, look, Apple knows that, again, these are smart people. They know that the eyes of the world are going to be upon them and expecting AI announcements. And so I think what they're going to most likely do is brand some things as AI that are not actually using this new generation of technique, and it's just using, you know, the previous generation, you know, like, you know, what we used to call machine learning. You know, these terms, and I know these terms are, you know, oftentimes vague and shifting around over time, but I think they might just, you know, show off stuff that is using that kind of technique and say this is AI powered, you know, just because those are the buzzwords that people expect of the day.
Yeah, the rumors surrounding the, like, Siri and the headset, I seem to recall reading something somewhere that was like a supposedly inside dirt on, like, the headset team didn't really want to use Siri, but, like, that's what's available to them. They kind of, like, wanted to go their own direction because Siri sucks so bad. They just, like, well, we, you know, like, I don't know if they want to use large language models. Maybe that predates that, but, like, they know they have a problem here because the headset is similar. Like, the interface to it is more limited than it is on a phone, iPad, or Mac. So you have to figure out, how do I manipulate things? I know the whole camera's looking at your fingertips and so on and so forth, but it's a harder problem, right? It's harder than just using a pointer or a cursor, you know, or touching the screen with your fingers. You can't do that with a headset. So let's use the voice assistant that our company already has. Oh, but that voice assistant is bad.
So
well, you don't want the headset to be bad. People working on the headset is that we want the headset to be good, and we do need something that's going to listen to us. And so I kind of agree that they're like, as they promote Siri and the headset, maybe they'll have a new suffix, Siri AI, Siri. I mean, I don't know how they'll go that far, but, like, maybe they'll just say, hey, Siri's in your headset too, and everybody loves Siri, and look how amazing it is. You can talk to it and make little VR apps, as the rumor was, or whatever. But, like, yeah, this is another one of the benefits of the headset. The fact that it blots out the sun, I think it can blot out the fact that Apple doesn't really have anything to show for it regarding large language models at WWDC, which is fine. They got a whole headset and a new platform. Isn't that exciting? I think they can get away with it this year. next year, when we come to WWDC next year, regardless of how the headset turns out, maybe next year it's finally just shipping to people or something. Next year, Apple needs to start having some kind of answers with large language models, because I think they've proven they're useful in enough context. And like the reason I gave the, you know, setting up the complications on your watch, you know, watch screen problem space, that is a limited domain where large language models can excel in ways that Siri absolutely has not, because you have to know how to talk to Siri in the special way that Siri understands. And even when you know, sometimes it does ridiculous things that don't make any sense, whereas large language models don't work that way. Again, if you've never tried one, go to one right now and ask it to do something with a limited problem domain, or even with a not particularly limited one, like I said, asking it to make a web page for you or something. It's really good about having a conversation with you and understanding what it is you want, as long as it's you're talking to it about something that it was able to train itself on that's out there in the world. And Apple can absolutely find a large language model and train it on enough data to understand watchOS complications.
Yeah. One thing, by the way, like in terms of like WWDC, you know, hopes and dreams here, one thing I would love to see, I don't know if it'll be this year, it'll more likely be next year, but I would love to see Apple make available to developers through APIs on the phone some large language model capabilities that they have optimized like crazy to run on their hardware. So for instance, you know, the Stable Diffusion algorithm for image generation, Apple actually, I believe it was that one, Apple actually contributed to the open source project or whatever to optimize it for running on Apple Silicon Macs or Apple Silicon in general. And so and then that kind of enabled people to make iPhone apps with it. I would love them to do more of that, that kind of thing, of like and build it into the OS so that we don't have to download like each app, you know, because right, a good example of this right now is if you want to transcribe sound into speech, into text. Apple has actually shipped an API to do this for a number of years now. It's called something like SF Speech Synthesizer, or Speech Recognizer, whatever. There were a number of problems with it. Number one, because I've been trying to do features like this in Overcast for years. You know, one of the biggest, clearest examples of where I could use this is like when you do clip sharing in Overcast to be able to show as part of the video clip the text. You know, many, you know, apps like TikTok, you know, they do this. They have this built in now. This is a common thing, and I need to do it at some point. And in the past, this was limited by a number of factors. Number one was in the past, I don't know if this is still the case, that API, to use Apple's built-in speech-to-text API, your app had to request and get access to the microphone, even if you were feeding it audio that was not from the microphone. So I could not, as a podcast app, feed the pre-recorded audio that I downloaded to my podcast app through their text-to-speech system or their speech-to-text system until I prompted the user for microphone access. And that alone was enough for me to say, I'm not using this feature, because I'm not going to ask my users, who are all, you know, educated nerds, for permission to access their microphone in a podcast app, because there's no reason I would need that except to be creepy and like spy on them with ads and stuff. Like, so I don't even want the appearance that I might be doing that. I don't even want the ability to access their microphone. I don't even want that to be possible in my app. So that alone ruled it out. But also, you know, it was using older style, you know, models and things to do the speech to text conversion. And it wasn't very good in my testing. Like I made a couple of test prototypes, granted myself microphone access just to see like, you know, how good is this? And it was bad. And it was too bad to ship. So I didn't ship it. Well, however many months ago, OpenAI released their Whisper model, and Whisper is really massively better. It's not a small difference. It is way more accurate. And there is a project called whisper.cpp where some guy has done amazing work in like transforming this thing that you would otherwise need a whole bunch of Python to run into a very simple C++ wrapper that you could make iOS and other apps with, and it runs fine on Apple stuff. And I tried that, and I built a prototype with that, and it was super easy to use. and the downside of using Whisper, there's two main downsides. Number one, if you use the large models that have like larger vocabularies and more accuracy, it's just too slow to run on an iPhone. Number two, these models are huge to download. Like the base model that provides like okay accuracy, decent speed, is something, I think it's something like 70 megs, And then if you want something more accurate, it goes into like multiple gigs very quickly. And this is just, it's untenable to run that. The way I would want to run that would be, you know, stuff like transcription of what you're listening to. You know, there's lots of things I could do with that if it was fast and you know, inexpensive computationally to run that. But if I had to download like a 2 gig model, you know, as part of the app to do those features or whatever, that's not going to fly. And if it's going to be super slow, it's not going to fly. Well, they could build in some medium-sized model into the OS if they wanted to, and they could use it themselves for their own speech-to-text stuff and then make that available to developers. They could also, for instance, optimize that model. You know, the reason why the whisper.cpp doesn't run very quickly on iPhones, one of the reasons is because Apple has not done their work to optimize that one the way they did with the Stable Diffusion. Also, the way these models usually work, if you're running in the background, you don't have access to the GPU. Or the neural engine, as far as I know, but you definitely can't run ML models on the GPU if your app is in the background. You can only it makes your app only use CPU based computation, and that makes them way slower to run in many cases. And this is the case for Whisper, and Whisper.cpp only ever uses the CPU. It doesn't have any access to the hardware acceleration besides, you know, CPU raw stuff, and so this makes it slower than it could be. So if Apple actually wanted to offer a really great dictation to speech API speech to text API, they could massively improve the API they've already offered for years by using this new kind of technique, a new kind of model like this, optimize it, let it run on the acceleration hardware, ship a base model with the OS, and all of a sudden every app could have really easy access to speech to text. That's the kind of thing that I think is more likely for Apple to offer with these new AI techniques sooner than having them offer some kind of like full-blown customer-facing, you know, quote, AI-powered feature. I think it's too soon for that, and that's kind of less Apple-y kind of thing.
The customizing watch face is a great example of how Apple would do it. It's not like you can have arbitrary conversations with the thing. Like, they would be very narrowly constrained. And I know the large language models out there now are supposedly constrained, but it's more like everything except for these five or six things they try to keep them away from, whereas this would be you can discuss nothing except for watch faces. And I feel like that is easier, especially if they train the model themselves, right? Which again costs money. And you know, regarding the speech text thing and the size of them and everything, there's a reason large language models are called large language models. They use tremendous amounts of storage and tremendous amounts of memory and tremendous amounts of compute. Not just for the training, which is itself huge, because obviously you're grinding through tons and tons of data, but even just for the part of it where it runs, the inference part of it where it does its thing, even that takes a substantial amount of power and resources, which is why I was saying the watch would have to be communicating with the server, obviously, and then even just communicating with the server would be taxing for the watch and drain the battery and so on. But
not to mention the servers.
Yeah, well, I mean, the servers, yeah. But again, to be that incredibly constrained to just be doing watch faces, it's what we talked about a while ago, and the people have actually implemented large language models sitting in front of essentially the functionality exposed by Siri, or like limit functionality that's already on the watch. The watch can already pick complications and configure them and put them in places on the faces. It's just a question of translating from speech to text and from text to what is this text telling me to do? And then, I, the watch, have APIs for doing all the things you're asking for. It's a very constrained problem space, which is miles from like what Microsoft did was like, here's Bing. You can talk to it about stuff. Good luck.
Yeah, but like ultimately, what I want to see from Apple in the AI age really is make a lot of this cool tech available on device for on-device use by apps that are not communicating with their own servers that can just run everything locally. And Apple has, you know, with the exception of having what seems like organizational or cultural trouble with AI machine learning techniques and people in general, that's a large issue they need to figure out if they haven't yet. And so far, it seems like they haven't. But what they have resource wise is they have all these supercomputers in everybody's pockets that have amazing hardware and software capabilities, and they care a lot about privacy and things running on device whenever possible and everything. And that's a level of sophistication and an amount of resources that their competitors don't have. So I hope Apple leans into that, and I think this is how they're going to ultimately tackle, you know, quote AI, leaning into on-device stuff as much as possible. And if they do that themselves, they will most likely do it in a way where there is an API for developers to hook into or use those same capabilities in our apps. That's what I'm hoping to see from Apple in this new age of these new styles of AI, is, you know, cool on-device capabilities that run quickly and locally, that don't need, you know, us to, as, you know, a developer of one app, we don't need to go train our own models. We don't need to, you know, go run a huge server farm or have our own, you know, OpenAI tokens that we have to use and figure out how the heck to pay for. Like, I want to see what Apple can deliver us on device that they will maintain, they will train, they will update it over time, they will make it faster over time, and let us build on top of it. And they have a very strong history of doing that in other areas. So I think this is what they will ultimately do whenever they get their act together on AI. And we don't know when that will be, and it probably won't be all at once. I'm hoping to see little hints of it this year. Even that, I think, is optimistic, but we'll see. And then maybe next year or the year after, maybe we'll see big stuff. And that's,
I mean, they're already doing that. They're already doing all of that. It's just a question of what letters they put on it. They used to put the letters M and L in front of it. Right. And now we're saying the letters A and I. What we mean is exactly what Apple has been doing, which is they do provide you a bunch of models that you can use, like that text-to-speech one that you were saying, yeah. You know, and they do improve it over years. They do make it run fast and hard, but they've done all of that. We're like, yeah, but the stuff that you have now, there's better stuff, Apple, that uses not the M and the L, but it uses the A and the I, and it's all this, you know, right? we obviously, there are different techniques to doing this, and the current technique that lots of other companies are experimenting with is better than what Apple is doing. So what we want is, Apple, do what you've been doing with all the things you used to call ML. Keep doing that. We love frameworks. We love you making it fast on your hardware. It's just that there's a new thing that does everything that you've been trying to do, but better. Not everything, but certain things it does better. So please give us access to that in a way that makes us not have to worry about it. And I do think that they will do that. And I just got done saying large language models are too big. You know, they're just way too big to even run at all. And even like phones or even Big Macs sometimes, that's why you have to communicate over the network. But that's today. Like, those things change. Like, part of what makes that tractable is just the march of progress. But part of it is also companies like Apple deciding that it is important for their SoCs to be good at doing this. And that can really knock down these things. It's the reason the SoCs we have today are so good at doing the things they do, so good at image processing, so good at, you know, doing the kinds of computations that has to be done on a phone, on a Mac or whatever. Those special processors for video encoding and decoding and, you know, the neural engine, all that stuff was developed because Apple said these types of functions are useful to do on a phone or on a Mac or whatever, and we want to do them in low power. I think that will come for large language models as well. I don't think we're going to, you know, models that currently run that require hundreds of gigs of RAM to do inference are going to run on your phone anytime soon. But I think there will be a meeting in the middle of, like you were saying, Marco, cut down versions of these things, limited problem space. And to be clear, with the limited problem space, you're like, oh, there's no way they can ever limit a large language model enough. It'll always be scary. I'm thinking of the scenario when you were talking about configuring the complications. It never answers back. The only thing it does in response to you talking to it is show you what it thinks you're asking for as you're screening your complications and basically says, you know, is this okay? You know, press okay or say okay, or like, it never talks back to you. It just does what you, and there's no way for you to accidentally have your watch insult you or something, or there's very few ways to have your watch insult you by arranging complications. I guess each complication was a letter, it could spell out a naughty word or something, and someone would figure out how to do it, but like, it's really limited problem space. But basically what we're just asking for is, you know, the promise of Siri? Well, large language models are currently delivering on a lot of that promise. I can have a conversation in text with a large language model and get it to do useful things that reflect what I'm asking it. No, it doesn't know anything about facts. No, it has no understanding of anything. No, I can't ask it questions and trust its answers. But I can ask it to arrange a bunch of complications on a watch screen. And the good thing about that is I'm the one who gets to say you did it correctly or you didn't. And if you didn't, I could say, no, the upper left should be carrot weather and not apples.